Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This is the hearing in In Re Miguel Angel Olano, Ninth Circuit docket number 18-80002. This is a hearing requested by Mr. Olano to respond to the order to show cause why Mr. Olano should not be sanctioned, suspended, or disbarred for violating the court's rules and orders as set out in the January 22nd, 2018 order to show cause. I understand that you are represented by counsel. Counsel, make an appearance, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Robert Burke,
All right. And Mr. Burke, would you mind coming up to the lectern? All right. Although it's a small, intimate, and wonderful courtroom, the acoustics are not great here, so we have microphones so that we'll be able to pick up the proceedings. And we are recording the proceedings today, so if it should be necessary to have any record that can be made available, it will be appearing on the court's website. All right, so you've received the order to show cause, you've submitted a response, you've submitted a pre-hearing statement, and I've studied those. And I am interested in hearing more from Mr. Olano. And I have some questions for him, and I wanted to know how you are intending to proceed today.
As in the past, Your Honor, I'm extremely comfortable bringing Mr. Olano to the stand and turning him to the commissioner for questioning.
Right.
The questioning that I would ask him would be very redundant, that it could be written documents and done something that might be more common than to the
office. All right. That sounds, that's fine. Do you intend to make any kind of an opening or closing statement?
I think what I would say in the opening and closing statement is very well encapsulated in the conclusory remarks of the pre-hearing statement. Mr. Olano recognizes that he's done the fall below this court standards. He's been diligent and continues to be diligent, as there are some things that are still in progress in remediating those in terms of probably key among them, putting in a good office management system. And he's prepared to talk more about
All right. All right. Mr. Olano, I'm going to give you the choice of either sitting there and talking in the microphone or talking at the lectern, whichever you would prefer. You sit there. That's the witness seat, and you're welcome to sit there. Yes, that's fine. Okay. Why don't you... And just put your stuff down, but before you sit down, I'm going to have the courtroom deputy administer the oath for you. Please have a seat. Mr. Olano, do you want to make any preliminary statement, or do you want me to just begin with my questions?
No, Your Honor, go ahead.
All right. So, when looking at the record of your practice before the court, there was a time before you started working with Ms. Vargas, Ms. Patricia Vargas. And I'm wondering if you could describe in what ways your practice was different before you started working with Ms. Vargas.
Okay. Basically, what happened was on or about July 2014, Ms. Vargas passed away. I believe it was like 4th of July weekend. I worked with her a lot. I did a lot of her appearances. I did a lot of her master calendars and merits in EOI Art Court. I even argued for her orally in the Ninth Circuit one time in Pasadena because she spent a lot of her time in Chicago. She passed away in July 2014. I took over her practice. She did a lot of Ninth Circuit. She helped me mentor me, especially in learning how to do Ninth Circuit and BIA appeals.
Okay. Let me go back and just fill in a few things. I'll get back to this area. let's talk a little bit about your educational background.
Yes.
Where did you attend college?
My undergraduate was University of Southern California, Bachelor of Arts 1996, BA History. And I got my JD, Rutgers, University of Camden, class of 2002, Your Honor.
Okay. And then let's just fill in a little bit of after 2002. Did you sit for a bar exam that year?
I took the California bar exam once. I didn't pass. I took the California bar exam second time. I passed.
What year was that?
2003, February. I got the results June or May 2003. I didn't get sworn in until June 6, 2003. And then I sat for the Nevada bar, and I passed. I don't recall the exact date of the Nevada bar, but it was. I got sworn in September of 2003.
Okay.
I don't recall the exact date.
So you've been admitted to practice in California and Nevada since 2003.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, what was your first employment after you passed the bar exam?
I worked for a tax defense firm, Capital Tax Services, in Woodland Hills, California. But I was only there for a few months. I was laid off. And then I went to work as a solo practitioner doing criminal immigration law, Your Honor. Because I had trouble finding a job. It was like a recession at the time.
What year was this? 2004?
No, it was about September of 2003. I only worked a couple months at Capital Tax Services. I looked for a job, but in the meantime, I would get family members, and people ask, especially like, you know, I come from an immigrant background. Both my parents are Salvadoran immigrants. I would get people from like my church or people to ask me, hey, do you do immigration law? Do you do criminal law? My cousin's in locked up in L.A. County Jail. I'm like, that's how I just dove into it. So, I mean, I did put my resume out there for law firms, but it wasn't successful. So that's how I plowed into it.
So, and how long did you continue with your criminal immigration practice as a solo?
How long have I been doing it? I've been doing it since 2003, Your Honor.
Oh, I see. So that's, you consider yourself a criminal immigration practitioner?
Yes.
Okay, getting back to where we were, now that we filled in the background. So our court records don't reflect the kind of issues that are laid out in the order to show cause before, I guess, you were more actively involved with Ms. Vargas. So I'm trying to take us back to a time before then, before you were so involved with Ms. Vargas's cases, and to see whether your practice was different then than it was after you became more active with Ms. Vargas.
Yes, I took over practice in 2014. She had like 200 clients. That expanded my client base. I retained her staff, and I realize now that, you know, I should have put in a better calendaring system, and that's...
But you didn't, I guess the court didn't notice that you experienced the kind of problems before 2014, or, let me see, not before, but earlier on before. So I guess what I'm searching for here is you've described in your response here that your practices adopted Patricia Vargas's practices.
Right.
Not good practices.
Correct.
But I'm wondering, was there a time before you adopted those practices whole scale that you were following a different set of schedules, of ability to comply with court rules before you bought into Ms. Vargas's approach?
Well, it was similar. I mean, I would use my Google calendaring. I would just use Microsoft Outlook, and I didn't respond to all the motions like the OSC said. And in retrospect, I should have immersed myself in that. And
did you have the same kind of? have you always had this practice in when you had a case in the Ninth Circuit of this sort of split billing? Agreement with your clients that you charge one amount for the petition for review, another amount if they wanted to go forward with the briefing, etc. Was that always your practice?
Usually, I adopted her billing practice. I didn't have that because the Ninth Circuit cases that I had, I would bill differently. I would take payments, but I would just do a flat fee.
You would have been in a lot better shape if you had continued to do that.
That's correct, yes.
So what was your typical engagement letter like when the cases that are mentioned in the order to show cause where there were issues with cases being dismissed because fees weren't paid, and the fees would be paid, and then a brief wasn't filed, the case would be dismissed. What was the typical client engagement letter or agreement for those cases?
The typical retainer and the engagement letter was, we would do the petition for review, we would require a second payment of...
So the petition for review costs $500, right?
No, we charged $1,500, Your Honor.
You charged $1,500. $500 of it was to pay
the fee.
The filing fee, and the other $1,000 was to prepare the petition?
The brief, yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Stop for a second.
I apologize.
My understanding is you charged a certain amount, the $1,500 just for filing the petition for review. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So then, according to what I understand from your statement, that $1,500, you collected that money, you were done. Unless they paid you more money, you weren't doing anything more. Am I correct?
No, Your Honor. We would continue on, and we would require another payment for the brief, but our retainer would say that if we didn't receive payment, we would withdraw.
All right. I don't see many instances where you actually withdrew.
That's correct, Your Honor. I should have been more diligent about withdrawing.
And so how much did you charge for the brief, preparing the brief?
It would be a payment of, let me get the retainer. Be another payment of $500 monthly.
$500 monthly?
Yes.
For a total amount of how much?
$4,500, Your Honor.
All right. So, how much would a client have to pay for you to actually file the brief?
Well, we'd file briefs sometimes. We lost contact with them. We'd file briefs anyway. So we weren't. In retrospect, I should have done motions to withdraw, and some of them I lost contact with. So there wasn't a set amount. We would lose contact, and then...
Okay, so how did it work here? You filed the petition for review.
Yes.
Eventually, you pay the fee, as you know.
Yes.
The court is very concerned about the amount of time it took and the amount of court resources it took to issue order after order asking you when are you going to pay. You have to pay, you have to pay. But in some of these cases, you paid the fee. Then the court set a briefing schedule. So the brief would be due 60 or 90 days after that date. So here you have a case. It's in the court. You've paid the fee. You've got a brief due date. So what would be the next step with the client? What communication would there be with the client at that stage?
We would send out letters, or we'd mostly use the phone calls. Sometimes we lost contact with them because many times they would just disappear on us. They would pay their initial retainer, and then they'd just disappear.
Okay, were there instances where you had a client that didn't disappear?
Yes, there were several, yes.
They didn't all disappear, right?
That's correct.
So when you had a client that didn't disappear, you knew the brief was due in another 45 days, let's say, what would you do? Did you say you'd send them a letter?
Yes, and they were mostly for a phone call. I would call them, or my secretary would call them.
Okay, so then they say, okay. Did they sometimes pay?
Yes, sometimes they would pay, yes.
And then did you file briefs in a timely manner in those cases?
Some of those briefs I didn't file timely, Your Honor, and then I would do the motions to reinstate or...
So when a client paid and fulfilled their side of the bargain, why didn't you file the brief?
I got overwhelmed by the calendaring of it. And
you just let the brief due date go and then wait for the court to issue an order dismissing it?
I shouldn't have done that, but that's what happened, Your Honor. I mean, that's...
Are you aware that you could file a motion for an extension of time to file a brief?
Yes, Your Honor. Now I do realize that after speaking with counsel and getting more up to speed on the regs.
So how, I know you inherited a bunch of clients from Patricia Vargas, but how do you now get your clients?
Most of them are word of mouth, or most of them I do from the beginning of the pipeline, which is, it would come in, there'd be like removal proceedings. I would be the one doing the merits at the EOIR level. And then if that would get denied, most of them would be like asylum claims from Central America or Mexico, all the way from the BIA and then the Ninth Circuit, Your Honor.
So what percentage of your appeals in the Ninth Circuit are cases that you actually handled below at the BIA or at the immigration judge here?
I would say about 80%.
80%?
Yes.
Because I noticed on a number of these cases, the attorney below is a fellow named Carlos Barrios?
Yes.
Is he somebody with whom you're affiliated, or? Because it looks like a lot of the cases that you've had were cases where he was representing the client in the administrative level.
Yes, he did. He would refer me some of those cases.
Are you sure that that was only 20% of your cases, or it would have been more than that?
I don't want...
That you've done in this court.
I am making an estimate to the best of my knowledge. I don't want to overstate it, but I don't want to understate it.
Do you think the 80% figure is pretty accurate? There are 80% of the cases that you litigate in this court are cases that you were the counsel below?
I haven't counted all the Carlos Barrios cases in the OSC, but litigated, but I would say, and then looking at the car over the weekend, getting prepared for this hearing, I did notice that there were some Carlos Barrios cases in there that he litigated below.
Okay, so let's go back to the filing fee. Let's say you paid the filing fee, the case is going forward, then the government files a dispositive motion. Motion for summary disposition, motion to dismiss. How does that sort of fit into your fee structure where you've said, pay me this to file the petition, pay me another amount for the brief? What about these dispositive motions? What would you ask of your clients then?
Well, sometimes we would call them, but then we would respond to them because most of them were like, they want to do a summary affirmance. And
yeah,
we should have responded to them.
Have you ever responded to a government motion for summary affirmance? Or a motion to dismiss by the government in that, you know, that stage?
I think I responded.
I'm talking about an initial response and not a response after the case is dismissed. You know, they make a motion. As a lawyer, you have an obligation either to oppose the motion, or if you don't oppose the motion, run the risk that the court will grant it as unopposed. Yeah? Does that make sense?
That's correct,
Your understanding of what a lawyer would do in that circumstance?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I don't see any case ever, not even one, where you filed an opposition to a government motion to dismiss. The only time I ever see you filing a motion in response is after the case gets dismissed, where you file a motion for rehearing. Am I correct, or do you have some examples of cases where you actually opposed a motion?
I don't have any examples, Your Honor.
Do you think it's accurate to say that you never have opposed a motion?
To my recollection, I don't think I've responded to one of those motions, but I have improved. I've gotten some of those motions now, and after I spoke with counsel, I got the OSC. Now we're responding to them right away.
Well, you understand that if you don't, you do run the risk that the court will grant it as unopposed. And then, if you thereafter want to oppose it, you have a very high threshold to meet because you've already defaulted on your response. So now you have a petition for a hearing where you have to show, you have a much higher showing why the court was wrong in granting this unopposed motion. So now not only do you have to oppose on the basis that you could have opposed earlier, but you have to also explain why you didn't oppose and why the court should at this stage change its disposition when you didn't timely oppose it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So I'm trying to give you a sense of how your practice appears to the court.
Yes, Your Honor.
So this is a big red flag when you fail to respond to a motion and then you file a petition for a hearing, which you've done a few times.
Yes, Your Honor, and I do acknowledge that, and I spoke with counsel after I got this, and he pointed me to the regs, and I've made corrective measures on that, and we're now responding to those motions in a timely manner.
Do you have any examples of a response to a motion that you've done recently?
Yes. If I may?
Yeah.
But it's not in the OSC.
Excuse me?
It's not in the OSC, Your Honor.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I assume it's more recent then because you seem to change your practice.
Right.
So I'm thinking maybe this would be a good subject for a post-hearing submission, rather than having you go through your records now.
Yes.
Why don't I ask counsel within 7 days after by next week, next Tuesday, to submit a post-hearing submission identifying cases in which you filed an opposition to a dispositive motion.
Yes, sir.
And I would also include any opposition to an order to show cause issued by the court why a petition for review should not be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. I don't know if there have been any or whether you've responded to any of those, but I would be interested in hearing about that as well.
Yes, sir.
So from what I gather from our discussion here today is that most of the cases where you filed the filing fee and that were ready to go were cases where a brief action was not filed in a timely manner.
That's correct, sir.
And then sometimes later on you would file a brief with a petition to reinstate. In what circumstances would you decide to file a brief after the case has been dismissed for lack of prosecution?
Well, I would try to do it like in all the cases I missed the date, and I would try to like remedy what I did wrong.
Well, so, but you've already told us that you didn't file a brief at all if the client hadn't paid the money, right?
Correct.
So if a client pays the money, you're obligated to file a brief, right? Were the cases where the client paid the money but you didn't file a brief?
It was regardless of whether the client paid the money. We would contact the client, we would ask him if he wanted to continue the case, and many times I filed the brief without him paying. That was the condition at all, Your Honor.
That's not my understanding from what your response says to the order to show cause. I thought you described a payment schedule that you adopted from Ms. Vargas where you would charge your $1,500 at the outset, file a petition for review, allowing you the authorization to withdraw if further payment were made. So if further payment were made, presumably, under this understanding, the case would get dismissed if they didn't pay you any more money. Isn't that the way the...
Sometimes we do, like, Yoshio Estrada Duque. Sometimes if we would do the case because I wanted to avoid harm to the client. So we would do the brief and... Sometimes I had trouble doing the brief because I would get the car and I realized that some of the issues weren't there. Like it would be like there was no social group there, or there was a firm resettlement issue, or the record wasn't developed enough. And I would try to contact the client. I lose contact with the client. Mostly, to do the brief, it was getting contact with the client.
But you would need to collect the money, yes, according to your agreement?
Yes, but in practice, it was like getting contact with the client, making sure they want to go forward. I did a lot of free work, too.
So... So you make, what about the brief due date? Where does the brief due date fit in with your practice? If the brief due date is 30 days away, you get in touch with the client, and the client says, okay, yes. Do you file a brief on time, or do you wait for the case to get dismissed and then file a motion to reinstate?
No. Most of the times, especially now, We filed a brief on time, or we asked for, or I asked for extensions, Your Honor.
And what about during the cases that were the subject of this order to show cause?
Some of them I let go because of the bad calendaring, which I've changed. But I was diligent in a lot of the other cases because, I mean, the day I got referred on November 15th, I was in the Ninth Circuit or an oral argument. So, I mean, I have been trying to be as diligent as possible with the Ninth Circuit. I haven't been, and I sought out counsel, and I have made changes, Your Honor. In a lot of these cases, we have done a lot of free work. I've done a lot of free work trying to remedy and avoid harm to the client, even if they didn't pay money. And because we didn't withdraw, that's when I did motions to reinstate in a lot of these cases.
Well, my understanding is that at least some, if not most, of the motions to reinstate types of cases were precipitated by a change in the status quo vis-a-vis your client. That is, they were issued an order of imminent removal. So then they may not have wanted to pay the money for you to file the brief, but now that they're facing this deadline of getting removed, then they get back in touch with you and say, oops, look, I'm about to get removed. Can you help me?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's when you file a motion or petition
to reinstate, right? That happened in Yoshio Estrada Duque, but some of them I should have filed a motion to dismiss in some of these cases where one gentleman got put in proceedings on a credible fear. That was Banda. And then on another, Duran Arias, we did a motion to reopen with the BIA. He's now reopened and in front of immigration court.
Okay. So here's one point. If the BIA grants a motion to reopen, do you know what the consequences with the pending petition for review in our court?
Yes, Your Honor.
What?
I should have done a motion to dismiss as moot.
Exactly, because it divests our court of jurisdiction. Correct. Once it's back, there's no more effective order of removal, so our court no longer has jurisdiction to hear the petition for review. So, in the event that you are successful in motion to reopen, congratulations to you, and please file a motion to dismiss the petition, because we won't necessarily know that that's occurred, but we'll keep monitoring this case in the court. And there's a lot of people here, not enough people, just a lot of people who are overworked trying to deal with a huge volume of cases. And when we have additional work that these folks have to do because attorneys aren't diligent, that's what leads to these orders to show cause.
I understand, Your Honor. And after I spoke with Mr. Burke, I do realize that that's what I should have done. And now I know that in those cases, I should have filed a motion to dismiss.
So when you file a motion to reinstate under the time pressure that we talked about, which has happened from time to time, the motion to reinstate has to be accompanied by, if it's a dismissal for failure to file a brief, the motion to reinstate must have a brief with it. And you've done that. You've submitted briefs.
Yes, Your Honor.
With your motion to reinstate.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think that those briefs that you've submitted under that kind of time pressure are as workmanlike and good as the other briefs that you've done when you've had more time?
The briefs do reference the law. Some of them, that's why I didn't do the briefs, because I try to make them as workmanlike as possible. I didn't want to put any, what's the word? I didn't want to do an inadequate brief, or sometimes I'd find a car and like the issue just wasn't there. I didn't want to do a frivolous brief. So.
But sometimes you did briefs just to reopen the case?
No. That wasn't my intention at all. The brief was not as a dilatory tactic. The brief was actually argued law that was supported by evidence in the record. There was no dilatory tactic or anything.
So, as you sit here today, do you think it's important for you to notify the court if you file a motion to reopen that's granted?
I do realize the expense that the court has and also the jurisdictional aspect. I have spoken with Mr. Burke. I do know that I should have filed a motion to dismiss, and from now on, we do a motion to reopen, or we get from the BIA. It is my practice now to file motions to dismiss.
And let's say a briefing schedule is coming up. You try and communicate with your client. You can't find your client.
Yes, and I have
to.
So what now is your practice?
We will either move to withdraw or just do the brief. We can't do any harm to the client. Or if the client's not cooperating with us, do a motion to withdraw, Your Honor.
That's the correct answer. Just to remove any doubt. And then if the client decides not to proceed with the appeal, do you also think it's appropriate then for you to move to voluntarily dismiss the petition for review?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, the client sometimes do tell me that they don't want to proceed, especially in the light of the law. That's one of the cases, Magdaleno, he didn't want to proceed.
So in 2015, in October, the court issued an order in a case called Duran-Arias.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know about that case. You mentioned it in the order to show cause.
Yes, Your Honor.
And this is a case that criticized you for your practice with respect to timely paying filing fees.
Yes, Your Honor.
How did you react to that order?
Okay, let me get my notes on that, and then I'm going to pull up the ADR.
And what did you change, if anything?
Okay, as a result of that case, the change came later after the OSC. But this was a case where we filed a motion to reopen the BIA. It got reopened and in light.
Excuse me for a second. The OSC was more than 2 years later.
Yes.
I'm talking about back in 2015 when you were put on notice about the burden that failure to timely pay the filing fees places on the court.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes, yeah, sure.
That's my order. In the Duran-Arias case. So in that case, there was a dismissal for failure to pay the filing fee, and then a motion to reinstate because you failed to calendar the deadline for paying the fee.
Yes, sir.
Which, in at least five other petitions for review, you were similarly dismissed. And this order involved the third motion to reinstate after such a dismissal. And it said, this pattern of delay burdens the court's limited resources and warn that your future failure to comply with the court's orders may result in the imposition of sanctions. So this is in October of 2015. You were put on notice that the practice of failing to pay fees in a timely manner was burdening the court's limited resources. So what did you do in response to that order 2 years before the order to show cause issued?
Um, my recollection, I didn't make those changes at the time, Your Honor. I shut up, but now I have.
All right, so what are you doing now about paying filing fees?
I'm asking for them up front. I'm telling the client, you know, you pay the initial fee for our fees plus what the court charges, $500 up front. I said the Ninth Circuit.
So are you waiting for the court to issue a docketing letter now, or are you paying it?
No, Your Honor, sorry. We're sending the check right away, say like two, three days later when we get a docket number.
So in response to the OSC, you talked about the initial 14-day extension to pay the fee. So I'm unaware of any automatic extension to pay the fee. I know that when we receive a petition for review, the court issues a docketing letter, says the fee's due, where is it? But the expectation is, as you just stated, is your new practice, that you pay the fee, you don't have to wait to be reminded about your obligation to pay the fee. It's an obligation that you have in conjunction with filing a petition for review.
Yes, and I spoke to counsel about that. I've been noticing the OSCs 1 or 2 days after I filed the PFR, but we send the check right away, like for same week now.
Have you ever asked for an extension of time to pay a filing fee?
I know we filed informal propers. I don't recall.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like if the problem was getting in touch with the client, if the client said, I don't have the money now, but I'll have it in another week, that would be inappropriate. I don't think it would be inappropriate to file a motion for an extension of time.
Yes, Your Honor. In light of what the court has said, but I changed my practice now to just, I don't even want to ask the court for an extension of time on paying the fee. I just tell the client before we take any new cases, you have to pay. If you want to retain my office, I tell the client, you have to pay the fee. No ifs, ands, and buts.
All right. So you talked a little bit about your calendaring practice changing. And I want you to describe what steps you've taken and in what way these steps have led to a system that you feel confident will address the issues identified in the order to show cause about paying filing fees, filing briefs, keeping up with what the court expects of you as a lawyer in terms of the court's deadlines for the various tasks to perfect the petition for review.
Okay, I purchased a new calendaring software called Practice Panther, and I placed all my calendaring there, for Ninth Circuit, and everything else on there. And I'm going to training to them right now using all the features, the Tickle system.
So now you can look up, you have all the resources right now to identify the cases that are pending and when all their due dates are.
Yes, sir.
Right. So do you know how many briefs you have due in the next few weeks at the Ninth Circuit?
I believe we have two. But I have to double check it. I have to go online.
Is that possible to do now?
Not right now. I don't have a signal.
All right. I think it's more than two. And I think deadlines are coming up pretty quickly on this brief. So I expect you to pay careful attention to those due dates and either submit briefs in a timely manner or move in a timely manner.
Yes, sir.
For an extension of time to file those briefs. And do you know when a motion is due for an extension of time to file a brief?
I believe it's 14 days.
Seven.
So
7 days before the due date. And what about your engagement letter, contract with your clients? We describe what your practice was with Ms. Vargas, adopting her practice, which I think it was flawed and led to a lot of the problems that we see in the order to show cause. So now when you have a client that is interested in pursuing a petition for review at the Ninth Circuit, what is your agreement?
It's a flat fee, plus we collect the filing fee, and we're going to do the whole work, and if we lose contact with them, they don't cooperate with us, we will move to withdraw. But now that's how I changed the...
And what does that fee cover, the flat fee?
The entire case up to the...
It includes filing the petition for review?
Petition for review and the brief.
Finding to dispositive motions, orders to show cause?
Yes.
Motions for extension of time, etc.?
Everything.
Filing the brief, appearing at oral argument if it's scheduled?
Yes. Because after consulting with ethical CLEs and also with my counsel, I just decided to junk that old system and just do a flat fee and just include everything in the contract and not worry about that. And counsel has informed me of the process, how to do a proper motion to withdraw.
Yeah. Well, from the court's perspective, when an attorney makes an appearance and is representing a client, the court expects the attorney to represent the client through the entirety of the case's history at the court. The court doesn't know that an attorney and a client ever have an agreement that says, well, you can do up to this point, and then the attorney's not going. So I think this is an appropriate step that you've taken, and I think it's the way an attorney should operate at the court. And I think that the system that Ms. Vargas had is not the way an attorney, and what you had was not the way an attorney should practice before this court.
I understand, Your Honor, and I've changed that. And also, I have taken cases all the way, many cases to the Ninth Circuit. I've done oral argument 3 times in front of the Ninth Circuit. I didn't charge the client additionally. I did an oral argument in Seattle. The only thing extra I asked for the client was extra money for airfare. And I took, that was a Tamaka's case about 3 years ago. I took that all the way to the oral argument with Reinhardt before he passed away, and then I did an oral argument November 15th in Pasadena. So I have taken a lot of these cases to the conclusion, and I didn't withdraw, and many times I did work without remuneration.
And so what is your fee for your clients to do full service appeal?
$6,000, Your Honor. And yes, I've changed that.
Same amount as it would have been.
Right.
Okay. All right. Let me move now from all the sort of process and procedural questions to some of the questions that the order to show cause raised concerning the substance of your briefing. So I think one thing that the order to show cause talked about, and I want to make sure that you get this message, is the concern that your briefs typically have failed to cite much testimony or record evidence in developing the argument. I'm not necessarily talking about the statement of facts, which says, well, this is what happened. What I'm referring to now is how you have used the legal theories that you've identified in the context of the particular case. So, are you following me right
now? I'm following you, yes, Your Honor. I didn't want to cut your train of thought.
Do you think that, does this seem plausible to you? Do you understand this concern, and do you think it's warranted?
I have spoken with counsel on this, and some of it is difficult because the record sometimes is sparse, and the difficulty is finding like a particular social group, especially on these asylum cases.
Yeah. Okay. Let me go through it one
sure.
case that may be helpful in identifying it. Do you have a copy of the brief in Elias Del Vidillo Valtierra? Okay. Counsel, I'm giving a copy
yes.
of this brief
all right.
to Mr. Olano. This is Ninth Circuit docket number 1771694. This is a petition for review. The petitioner is Elias Delgadillo Valtierra, and it's a case concerning asylum and other forms of relief, withholding, cat relief. So just flipping through the brief, I think that there's an adequate statement of the case.
That's right.
You describe procedurally what occurred, the jurisdiction, and I do note that there are references to the administrative record
yes, Your Honor.
In the statement of the case, and there's an adequate discussion of jurisdiction and the standard of review. Then we move to the argument section. So the argument section talks about, I guess the main issue in this case was whether there was an adequate particular social group. So there's a lot of discussion here, and there's statements of what the law is, what the Real ID Act says, what the criteria are for eligibility for asylum, what a well-founded fear means, what factors you have to show. All of this is fine and well. There's only one sentence in the entire argument here that actually talks about, this one key sentence. If you look at page 6, it's talking about fear of persecution. The very bottom sentence. So there's all this. And then here's the argument that you're making about how to apply all this law to this case. It says, petitioner claimed the requisite future persecution as a returning Mexican national accompanied or visited by his minor United States citizen children who will become targets of indiscriminate and widespread violence in the hands of the drug cartels and associated criminal elements who the Mexican government is unable or unwilling to control. So, first of all, there's no citation there to the record, which there should be. And then there's no real further development at that point. And you've said what the law is, you've kind of identified, okay, here's this group, but you need more. There's more needed. Why does the law apply to this group? Why should this group be given the treatment that you want it to be given? How does this group fit into all this law? It's just not enough to just say, here's the legal theory, here's what I say. You have to then develop it more. You have to articulate it more. There was a case, I think, where you might have been co-counsel. Let's see. I think I'm going to note that somewhere here. This is a case called Pineda de Rodriguez, where okay. Tanya Pham was co-counsel with you. You know that case?
Let me check.
It's 16-73389. Do you know, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Tania Pham, attorney?
Tania who?
Pham, P-H-A-M.
No, no.
Maybe I'm mistaken then. Okay, maybe I got my facts wrong about that. But the principle remains the same about this. Now, I can talk to you about the concept of developing your case by applying the law to the facts. Here, you haven't really applied the law to the facts. You've stated what the law is, you've stated what the fact is, but we're missing that argument why these facts satisfy the legal criteria. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I understand.
Making sense in context, though, is what I'm hoping for.
Yes, Your Honor, I do realize that I guess if it's Iraq, I should more A in the C.
If you're not getting it, I'd rather have you tell me. I really want to make sure that this is something that it's a skill, an art and a skill that. It's important for lawyers to develop this, to be effective appellate litigators. Now, it's not something that you're born with. It's something that you can learn, and you can learn it and develop it. And there are some ways that you can accelerate that development. One way that I'm going to recommend that you consider, assuming that you consider practicing in the court, is to take advantage of the court's mentoring program.
Yes, sir.
Do you know about that? That the court has such a program? You can locate it on our website, ca9.uscourts.gov.
Yes, sir.
ca9.uscourts.gov. There, if you look at the attorney section, on that page, you can see that the court has a mentoring program. The mentoring program is comprised of attorneys who are experienced, skilled attorneys who have offered to volunteer their services to assist other attorneys in becoming more proficient practitioners at the court. So you can get an attorney to take a look at your brief and give you some ideas, and one of those attorneys would, in the context of a particular case, I think, be able to give you feedback on your writing that would demonstrate this point for you, and maybe that would be a very good way to proceed. And I would recommend that you do that.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Burke has recommended me some CLEs. I have looked for some Ninth Circuit CLEs.
Right.
I couldn't find them scheduled recently. I would have taken them.
Right. So that's another. That was the second thing.
Right.
There are programs both in immigration practice and in appellate practice that can give you, I think, helpful guidance on effective brief writing. I realize a lot of the clients that you represent are in predicaments where they have little likelihood of success given the state of the law, and your obligation as a counsel is to zealously represent them, and you kind of have to walk this tightrope between your ethical obligation of zealous representation of your client and your obligation as an officer of the court not to file frivolous filings. And that's a difficult challenge, I think, for immigration practitioners. But it's one you can do. And if you have these tools use your best thinking and express it persuasively in your briefs, I think you can accomplish that. And and discharge your ethical responsibilities, both to your clients and to the court.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
But I will definitely look into the mentoring program. I did attempt to look for a Ninth Circuit writing CLE, which Mr. Burke recommended to me. I couldn't find any of the providers.
Okay.
But I did take some CLEs on office management already.
Okay. Well, that's a key. But this is a separate and different issue that needs to be addressed.
Yes, Your Honor, of course. And
so. For example, one thing I talked about was the way in which you communicate, this ability to do it. But one other thing that the order to show cause talked about was of your legal analysis, just a basic understanding of what's appropriate to argue at the Court of Appeals. And that is, and I think we touched upon this briefly, and this is the question of the particular social group.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we noted in the order to show cause that in some instances there was a particular social group that was articulated and identified at the BIA, and then in your brief here you articulate a different particular social group. Now, do you understand why you can't do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Well, now, especially in EOIR, the judges are now making us write a particular social group statement.
But why can't you raise a different social group at the Ninth Circuit than you raised at the BIA and in the Immigration Court?
It wouldn't be. That's not what was raised at the record. It has to be argued.
It has to be exhausted.
It has to be exhausted at the agency level and at the BIA level.
So sometimes your particular social group is more persuasive than the one that was argued below.
Correct.
Can't argue it here if it wasn't raised below. I mean, I suppose at that stage, if you were to look at a case like that, if you were the attorney below, you know, slap yourself. But if you're taking over a case for somebody else, then I suppose you can move to reopen saying counsel didn't identify the appropriate particular social group. It really is this one.
Yes. I should have done a motion to reopen, Your Honor. That would have been more appropriate so the court, the jurisdictional.
Do you have anything else you want to tell me at this stage? So I'm done with my detailed questions. Is there any kind of statement you want to make or anything else that you want to make sure I understand before we're done with the hearing?
No, Your Honor, I think we've been, I made the changes and I enjoy immigration law because I like to help people and I like to help especially like in my family and my social group.
Do you think you've been a competent practitioner before this court? Let me pose that question slightly differently. Do you think from the court's perspective, that you've been a competent practitioner before this court?
I don't want to minimize the behavior that led to the OSC, and I realize my errors, but I, to the best of my ability, I have tried to litigate these cases, Your Honor, and I have taken steps to remedy the deficiencies in these cases. I don't want to minimize that at all.
Couple of other Okay, so we've taken a look at what's happened since the order issue cause. This is January 22nd. So since then, there were three cases that were dismissed for failure to prosecute. First case was a case called Gil Cisneros. Case was fully briefed. It was dismissed on January 31st after you failed to respond to the court's third request that you submit paper copies of the brief.
Can you explain why the case got dismissed? Why you didn't submit paper copies?
That was a calendaring error on my part, and I have to double check, but I think we did submit the briefs.
You need a, no, you don't have, you don't have, have you searched, because I think there's an attorney, there's a way to get a signal in here. Have you searched for a link? For a wireless connection?
No.
Why don't you do so?
All right. No, Your Honor. Oh, wait. COA 9, public. All right. Oh, I'm not able to, Your Honor.
You're not getting it?
No.
Okay, so this is one I want you to add to that post-hearing submission. A detailed description of why the case was dismissed.
Okay.
16-73663, Cisneros versus Sessions. This, and what's frustrating about this, it was fully briefed, ready to be submitted to a panel for decision, and but wasn't because you failed to submit to three requests for paper copies. You know you have to file paper copies of the briefs.
Yes, sir.
The second one was dismissed only a couple of weeks ago in a case called Lozano Fuerte versus Sessions. And that was dismissed because no opening brief was filed.
Yes, the brief is, I'm working on it right now, Your Honor.
Did you file a motion? You didn't file a motion for extension? You didn't file a motion to reinstate?
I haven't filed a motion to reinstate, but I mean, I'm filing
a brief. You haven't filed a motion for reinstate because you don't have a brief.
Right.
And that was April 25th. That was dismissed.
Yes, sir.
So, okay, so you just told me a moment ago that you've changed your practice.
I just bought.
But now we have a case where a brief was dismissed. A case was dismissed for failure to file the opening brief, which I thought you told me that you were.
Yes, Your Honor. I just got behind on filing that brief. I'm writing it right now. I'm going to do a motion to reinstate.
Okay, so if you could go back in time to a month ago.
I should have filed a motion to extend the briefing.
Then in a case called Noe Sandoval, this is another fee matter. So the petition was dismissed on March 16th. You paid the fee 6 days later, but not until the case was dismissed. So, how did that happen under your new system of taking care of matters?
I did send in the fee.
After the case was dismissed, 6 days later. So I thought that you knew after the order of that this wasn't going to happen anymore.
Yes, and I took the remedy steps of just submitting the fee, Your Honor. And
so how do I know this isn't going to happen next week, the week after?
What's going to change?
I just bought the Practice Panther software recently, and I'm getting all that.
There's also a pending motion to dismiss in another case, 187037. What?
In the fee case.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. In that case, there's a motion to dismiss. In the case you paid. Are you aware of that?
Yes, sir.
And are you intending to file an opposition?
Yes, sir. We'll file an opposition forthwith.
So, I thought I understood you to say that your practice was now to pay the fee at the time, but this case was dismissed for failure to pay. Is that because this happened before you got? Why? You tell me. Why was this Sandoval case dismissed for failure to pay the fee when I thought your practice now is to pay the fee at the outset?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think there might have been a delay. I don't think.
Your response to 187087, description of why the fee was not paid in a timely manner, why the case was dismissed, what steps can be taken in order to avoid this from happening again. And then get back to Lozano Fuerte, or a description of why the case was dismissed for failure to file the opening brief.
Yes, sir.
Dismiss in that particular case. It was a different case. So you don't need to, in the Sandoval case, there is no motion to dismiss that I'm aware of. It was a separate case where there is a pending motion to dismiss. But I do want you to explain why the fee was not timely paid in Sandoval.
Yes, sir.
Why it took a dismissal to get the fee paid, which is what got you here in the first place.
Yes, sir.
Right. Anything further, Mr. you wish to raise?
I'm sorry, what was the last?
Anything further that you wish to raise or talk about before we end this hearing?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Burke, anything further?
I would like to just ask about 4 or 5 questions.
Can you come up to the lectern, please?
When did you contract with Practice Panther and put that system into place?
Let me double check.
I can find it, I think, is one of the exhibits.
Oh, okay.
Definitely. But even approximately,
I want to say about 2 weeks ago.
And when did you and I first start talking about a practice management system?
Okay, right after the OC, when we were doing the response, I looked into it. I looked into Abacus Law. I met with a representative of Smokeball, which is another software company. Finally, I just made the decision and pulled the trigger on Practice Panther due to your recommendation and also the fees involved.
And with any of these softwares that you looked at, what have you learned in terms of the training and implementation time to get those things operating fully?
That it takes time. You have to input the thing, and they're very integrated with other software, so you need several hours of training.
And when are you having your training? Let me not presume anything. Have you received any training from Practice Panther, which is the one you've gone with, yet?
Not yet. I had to reschedule it.
Okay. So. And when is that scheduled for?
I have to call the rep.
Okay. And overall, how many different packages did you look at or speak to representatives from for practice management before deciding?
I looked at 5 or 6. I looked at the finalists were Smokeball and Practice Panther. I looked at Abacus Law. I didn't like the features. There was one that was suited only for immigration, but that was more for like forms and EOIR, so I didn't choose to take that one.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was cheaper, but since this is more an appellate issue and calendaring, the better one was Practice Panther.
Okay. So you have it, but you haven't had the training or been fully implemented yet?
That's correct.
And when did you say you have the training scheduled?
I haven't made an appointment yet with the rep. The rep is in Florida, so I have to call him to make a date that he's available and I'm available too.
And did he indicate how much time he needs to spend with you to get that?
About 2 hours.
But you've already got the system, you've got your account, you're set.
Yes.
You're able to watch the videos.
Yes, I've been watching. That's what I've been doing. I've been watching videos that he sends me a link through email. I watched about 3 videos so far, about half an hour each.
Why? Do you think that that's going to affect things in your practice?
Because Practice Panther is a software that integrates Microsoft Word documents with the calendaring. So it's going to improve the production as well as the calendaring, so I don't miss anything.
Supplement according to the instructions, so I'm going to count my questioning there if there's anything further I'll include.
When you do a brief at the Ninth Circuit, does anybody help you?
Yes, I do get some help.
So how does the brief production process work? Who does the initial drafting, etc.?
One of my staff members, but then I take over. I do most of it.
Yeah, like a paralegal who does the first shot.
Especially with these cases with a particular social group in asylum. They're difficult cases.
Right. So after this hearing is done, we're going to wait a week and get your supplemental submission. Then I'm going to prepare a report and recommendation about what I think is the proper disposition here. You'll receive a copy of that. You'll have an opportunity to file any comments or objections. And then the report, along with any submission that you want to make, is going to be sent to a panel of judges. And they will make the final decision on whether and to what extent there should be discipline imposed. Understand that?
Yes, sir.
Any questions?
No, Your Honor.
Any further comments or statements? All right. Mm-hmm. So this matter will then be submitted pending the receipt of post-hearing submission and then the preparation of the report and recommendation.
Thank you. All right.